This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear from Egyptian professor Osama Madni, who is speaking this week at Western Michigan University about the political and cultural changes in Egypt. But first, Western Michigan University has been recognized for its efforts to help students after they age out of the foster care system. On Friday, a statewide summit on helping foster care youth succeed is being held at Western. There's also a free movie screening on Thursday. Fostering Success Michigan begins at 9 o'clock Friday morning at the Fetzer Center. Maddie Day is Director of Outreach and Training for the Center for Fostering Success here at Western Michigan University. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit, first of all, about what's going on Friday and how it relates to this kind of larger idea of students going from foster care and then into college and being successful.
Yeah. Friday will be our third annual Fostering Success Michigan statewide summit, and we're very pleased to be back at Western Michigan at the Fetzer Center. It'll be a gathering of over 200 professionals and students from across the state that are really focused on increasing access and success for students from foster care in higher education. And, you know, we really take a large scope. We bring a diverse group of partners together, anyone from high school and middle school counselors to other college professionals at other campuses across the state, and our youth and alumni of foster care. So we'll be offering skill-based workshops that were really focused on helping our partners find one thing that they can take away that they can use to transform their practice, whatever that may be, that will transform the education to career pipeline for our students from foster care.
And tell us a little bit about Thursday. There's going to be a movie shown at the Alamo Draft House, Short Term 12. What's this movie about?
Yeah, so Short Term 12 is an independent film that was really focused on kind of giving an inside look through the eyes of a young woman who works at a residential foster care facility. And, you know, for me, I think it's really important that we look at these spaces that are often forgotten about for our youth and children in foster care. Residential care is one of those places that we don't talk a lot about, but especially in Michigan, it's really important that we understand. We have a high number of youth who experience residential care placements. And so we felt that this movie was a great way to bring that dialogue to the community. And it's really beautifully shot, and I think offers a lot of space for conversation. And following the movie, we actually will have a talk back that will be led by three alumni of foster care. They're going to sort of have a facilitated discussion with the audience about this movie and about the experience of foster care.
Is it a fairly realistic portrayal of children in residential foster care?
You know, I think so. Of course, it takes some liberties, but, you know, I think it's fairly realistic. And when I first watched this movie, I actually spoke with a colleague of mine who is the policy director for a national organization called Foster Club. And I said, you know, Tim, you lived in foster care. You lived in residential placements. What do you think? And he was like, this was the film that spoke my story for me in a way that I don't think that I've been able to do before. So to me, I haven't been in foster care, but hearing from a friend and colleague say that, it really felt quite profound.
So what do foster care children need if they're going to age out of foster care and yet move on to college, hopefully get a degree, and go on from there?
Mm-hmm. You know, we focus a lot when we are helping youth transition out of foster care on this idea of independence. And I actually think that we're kind of wrong when we say that. I don't know any successful adult that is completely independent. And I really believe that we need to instill a sense of interdependence and really a sense of how do you ask for help and some of those really, you know, strong life skills that help us navigate through whatever may come. You know, we can offer financial literacy training, and that's important. We can help students get into college, and that's extremely important. But if they can't navigate through those systems of making it through college into career, then we're not really serving the youth that come through foster care the best way that we can. So I think having mentors is huge. I'm big on professional mentors, career mentors, and then also just, you know, finding those ways that the community of youth and alumni from foster care can really come together. So building that community, which is one of the things that we're trying to do with Fostering Success Michigan, is really important.
But a certain degree of independence, it does seem, is required, because many of us, even after we get out of college, turn back to our parents at some point,
sure.
perhaps for financial help or maybe to move back sure. if the job market's lousy. So there is a certain sort of, an independence that you do need, right, if you're going to make a successful transition?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important that our young adults from foster care feel strong and equipped to, you know, actively engage in the professional world, the career world, and, you know, find jobs, find housing on their own. So absolutely, we do need to instill that sense of self. I think that we all, you know, like you said, look back and maybe have parents or family members that we can kind of fall on. And so for our young adults from foster care, when they don't have those folks, I think it's really looking to who can step in that gap for them.
Are there things that maybe the rest of us take for granted as we go through college and maybe our early adult years that if you're a foster student or former foster child, you need those things and they're important?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes up all the time and that we work with, Western has done an amazing job addressing this issue, but it's housing. And so we think about summer breaks, of course, you know, and there's different things you can do, but we don't think about winter breaks. We don't think about spring break, where oftentimes, you know, university housing closes down. And especially here in Michigan, where it's very cold in the winter, we always are concerned that our students who are in college are, you know, couch surfing or maybe, you know, homeless in other ways over those breaks. So those are the kinds of things that I don't think we necessarily think about until you have that conversation with somebody and you say, okay, so we're going to be on break for 3 weeks. What's your plan? And they're kind of looking at you like, yeah, I don't know. You know, and that's something that I took for granted. I was able to go back home to, you know, my family's home. So those are things that we really want to address for our students. We want to make sure that they have a plan. And at a place like Western, they actually keep the dorms open through all of those breaks, which is a huge gift to those students.
Is the CETA Scholars Program here at Western Michigan University becoming something of a model? Are other schools looking at it and saying that makes sense? That's something that we can duplicate?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really exciting. You know, I get calls all the time, at least once a week from all over the country, folks calling us, really asking about, you know, how are they doing this at Western? And tell me about the CETA Scholars Program. And by sheer numbers alone, the fact that they are serving on campus 160 students from foster care, it makes them one of the largest programs in the country. By programming, you know, in addition to that, they have such extensive programming, such holistic programming, that they're really able to, you know, touch on a variety of issues that students, any student would face, but that are of particular need to address for our students from foster care. Things from identity to financial planning, basic life skills, and it goes on.
Do you think that that is perhaps building the future network that you talked about earlier, that these students who, assuming they're successful and they go out and they get degrees and they have some success in finance or whatever, are living somewhat comfortably, mm-hmm. They can give back to the students who come along after them through the foster care system?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the best things about my job is I get to go to graduations all across the state. And so this year I went to 3 different graduation ceremonies here at Western, at Eastern Michigan University, and the University of Michigan. And at all 3 of those ceremonies, students, you know, got up and they made some acknowledgments. And at all 3 of them, they said, you know, I'm going to give back. I'm going to do my part because somebody did probably more than their fair share to help me get to here and through here. And now I want to come back. And that, I really think, speaks volumes to the positive experiences that our students are having through campus support programs. But really, like you said, that community that's being built both on campus and in that community. So for our students here at Western, they're not just tied into Western, but they're really tied into Kalamazoo. And they talk about wanting to work here. They're looking for jobs here. They talk about wanting to come back for alumni activities. And that's really the opportunity that having a program like the CETA Scholars Program has built for them.
When you find mentors for people who have gone through foster care, perhaps in the CETA Scholars Program, who makes a good mentor?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I don't think that it has to be anybody with a, you know, special set of skills. I think it has to be somebody with a lot of patience. So maybe that's a special skill, depending on who you are. But, you know, I think somebody with a lot of patience and an openness to understanding, really understanding an experience, it's probably very much unlike their own, because I think as much as the issues of, you know, foster care really, they intersect quite a number of statuses. So ability status, gender and sexual identity status, race and ethnic identity status. You can have some of those things in common, but the experience of foster care really cuts across all of those. And no one experience is going to be alike. And so being open to hearing what these students, some of them have gone through, and then also helping and just sharing your life with them so that they can see, what is it like to be a professional that comes to work every day? What is it like to be, you know, a partner, a husband, a wife, etc.? What is it like to be a parent? You know, many of these students, they're looking for those mentors both professionally, but also in life.
What else do we need to do? I mean, you know, beyond the CETA Scholars Program, beyond fostering success, what are other things that, that we're finding that former foster children need as they age out of the system?
Mm-hmm. One of the big ones that we've had recently was through the Affordable Care Act, there has been an extension of Medicaid that has been a significant advantage to our students from foster care. So now they're able to, much like any other young adult, they're able to stay on extended Medicaid through up to age 26. And so just having that stability of healthcare is a huge advantage to our students, as we would know for, you know, any of our own children. So that's one big win. I think another, you know, big thing, and of course, I'm going to bring it back to education because that's what I'm really focused on, but it's really setting the expectation of success. And, you know, that's something that we don't necessarily lead with, but I think it's actually, that dialogue is actually changing. And I would like to see it change even more significantly. So I don't hear people saying, well, I'm just so glad that they got through high school. I hear people saying, oh, it's so wonderful that they got their bachelor's degree. Oh, it's so wonderful that they, you know, went to a technical college. They got this credential. That's really what we want for all of our children. And we need to start setting that expectation of success for our students from foster care.
But a lot of research shows that the early years of education are pretty critical for mm-hmm. the payoff you're going to get down the road. So does that mean focusing there as well on the younger children who are in foster care and making sure that they are being well educated?
Absolutely. Education stability is a huge, huge issue. And it's something that I'm, you know, talking with our partners, you know, high school and middle school counselors, absolutely. And even our early childhood development partners, just saying, you know, anything that we can do to increase the stability of education for our young people in foster care, we have to do. Michigan actually has a very strong McKinney-Vento policy, which is a federal policy that has really helped to increase education stability for all of the children K through 12 in foster care. And so that's been a huge benefit to this state. And I think tapping into resources like that, but also just some awareness, even as early as middle school, you know, educators don't necessarily know when students are in foster care or what the situation is. And I would really like to see our child welfare system and our education system partner more so that when students are in foster care, educators understand what's happening. And so they're not punishing them for acting out necessarily when really it's the only way that they can say, hey, things are going wrong at home and I don't know how to tell you. And so I think if we can have more communication between those two systems from an early age and then ongoing through middle school and high school, we'll see better outcomes.
Maddie Day, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Maddie Day is Director of Outreach and Training for Western Michigan University's Center for Fostering Success. More information on Friday's Fostering Success Michigan Summit and Thursday's screening of the film Short Term 12 can be found at WMUK.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The political and cultural changes in Egypt are the subject of a discussion on the Western Michigan University campus this week. Osama Badni is a professor of English literature at Menifee University in Egypt. He is currently studying at Western Michigan University on a Fulbright grant. Madani's address, part of the Center for Humanities' Changing Climates series, is titled No Country for Old Men, Shifting Cultural Borders in Egypt. Osama Madani, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what do you mean by Egypt being no country for old men?
Well, let's go back a little. Before 2011, before the revolution, the demographic shape of Egypt had developed to the extent, population-wise, that 70% of the country was actually age-wise under the age of 30. Over 50%, that is 50 million, were actually under the age of 25. And that's a lot of young people. Now, with the previous regime, the Mubarak regime, this had continued for 30 years. Mubarak had reached an age where he only trusted his generation. So we had Mubarak, we had the cabinet, we had all his ministers, the prime minister. They were all over the age of 70, 75 even. And they gradually lost touch with the people, especially with the young generation. And they continued to treat them in a patriarchal, condescending manner. And many of these youth felt invisible in their country, and they felt that they did not belong. And they simply nobody listened. And this was one of the main reasons for the revolution, is that this overwhelming young people felt that they were let down, they were left over, and they had to revolt to bring down this corrupt regime of Mubarak. Egypt is an Arabic country. It's a highly patriarchal country, but it had reached the point where they could only see each other, this old generation. They talk to each other. They listen to each other. They take decisions based on their views of life. And they totally forgot this young generation. And this is a young generation that grew up in an age of technology where they were exposed, where they had access to the internet, to Facebook, to Twitter, and they can see how it is with the rest of the world. And so they reached the point of explosion where they had to just go out and get rid of this regime and try and establish a new age for Egypt.
So how did the shift come about culturally? What did these young people do? How did they sort of channel their energies, and what has it meant for Egypt, say, in the 3 years since the revolution?
This is a good question. It started way before the revolution. Before the revolution, Egypt was highly militarized, and it was very difficult to freely speak out your ideas in any form of art. So what they did is in any form politically, that is, I'm sorry. So they resorted to the various forms of art. One important means of this was in the letters, in literature. All publishing houses in Egypt are state controlled. 5 years before the revolution, two or three private publishing houses began to take in the literary productions of these young men and women in their 20s and early 30s. And one of them was Merit Publishing House, and they began to publish the works of these young writers whose literary productions were highly deconstructive of the traditional cultural heritage of Egypt, in which we are so proud of. We have grown up with the legacy of Egypt being the mother of our lands, being the country that every other country looks up to. And this young generation had realized otherwise, that we are no longer this. And actually everyone is looking down on us. And this is what they did. They deconstructed their heritage intentionally as a wake-up sign to their generation that we are the bottom of the ladder in every aspect of life. So they would they would use minimalistic language, they would use deconstructive languages, they would go after their heritage, whether it is Pharaonic, whether it is Islamic, and they were very harsh on this. So they were accused of a very serious crime then, and that could lay you in prison for life, and it's called tarnishing the image of Egypt. It's silly, but it's constitutional. So many of them, of course, these publishing houses, most of them were shut down, and many of these writers were actually imprisoned and pardoned afterwards as a sign of good intention on the part of our regime.
But okay, but they were pardoned afterwards, but these publishing houses were still out of business?
How it works in Egyptian politics is that, as I said, we were talking earlier, they do it delicately. They do it smoothly. They know how to play the game. They don't put them out of business because they know they have a smoldering generation down there. So they close them and then they open them again and then they give them subsidies. They lure them to take a different direction. Many of them actually go with this. But some, like Merit Publishing Houses, they stick to it. They stick to their message. So the regime never allows a dissenting voice to go out of business. But it's a cat and mouse game.
They're given encouragement to pursue other ventures,
and it often works. Unfortunately, this is one. Another was in the written word. This was before the revolution, 5 years before the revolution. This was vibrant. Media-wise, it's a problem because Egypt is a highly illiterate. The population is high; 50% are illiterate. So the written word is not that problematic in Egypt. What's problematic is the media production. So if you go on YouTube and you post a song, or if you go on YouTube and post a documentary, that poses a problem. And many of these artists did this, but they had to, at one point in their life, leave the country.
Does a vibrant art and literature culture mean good things otherwise, or is it sort of two separate things? You have this vibrant culture, and at the same time, the political situation doesn't seem to get any better.
The political situation, well, it doesn't. Yes, the political situation doesn't get any better. It is cruel, and it's cruel on this young generation particularly, because they are the ones who are not easily convinced. Many of our population now, 50%, 60% even, unfortunately, those who are highly illiterate and those who benefit directly from the fact that the old regime cronies have to still be in power, they are the ones who have been, okay, they're convinced now that the revolution has achieved its ends and goals and this is a new start. But this young generation is the one that who are not convinced at all. And yes, they're 40%, they're maybe 35%, but that's a big, big number. And they do pose problems. They feel because they've been crushed and they've been blamed as being the traitors of Egypt now by the majority for not letting the country, between inverted commas, move ahead to its future. They are doing the minimum restraint in their revolutionary maneuvers against the regime. So they resort to art as a wake-up call, as a wake-up sign to not only the young people of Egypt and to the older generation, but to the rest of the world, that this is the most we can do. Otherwise, we will lose our lives. And the regime will be condoned for taking our lives away. So we have to resist, but we need help. And this is the only way we can resist, is to, again and again, claim public space. And these are the public squares of Egypt. Over and over again, they occupy them and they send the message, but then they have to leave quick. And Unfortunately, countries like the US, which subsidize Egypt and billions of dollars, do not send a clear message that you need to cater for this young generation, because this is the generation that owns the future of this country.
Given what you just spelled out for us there, that all this young generation has is the ability to take over a public square for a short period of time, give us a reason, if you could, to be optimistic about Egypt and where it's heading, perhaps with new leadership, with some changes coming. Give us a reason that we should look at Egypt and think that 5 or 10 years from now, we could be having a very different conversation.
I can only be optimistic. I cannot be otherwise. Because now there is the message being sent out to us that if you don't like this country, leave.
And that message comes from where? From the regime?
Yeah, yes. And it is being spelled out now to everyone. This is the Egypt we want. This is the Egypt we desire. This is the future we are seeking. You are downright traitors. If you don't go down with us, just leave. But again, this is our country, and we refuse to leave. Bad as the situation may seem, and it is bad, but we refuse to leave our country, because that's the only thing we have. I can only be optimistic because we've tried over and over again throughout the years the military as a ruling regime. And the people, it seems, again, and this has been a long, long heritage of Egyptian culture, is that if the regime comes from the military, then you feel secured. This is a message that has been ingrained in the fabrics of our culture. But we believe that with the successive presidents who have a military background, one day, this country will realize that this is not how to go about doing it. Now there is the message being sent out, as I talk to you now, that this is our best and only option, is to have a military general. And otherwise, a civilian is inexperienced and is weak. These are the two labels always being put on a civilian president. But we will learn the lesson. But we can only learn it, and that's my belief, only through what this young generation is doing. Because I teach them. I know how they think. I know that they are smart, but they are not given the chance. They are crushed, and they are sidelined, and they are cornered, and they don't speak, but they are patient. And when you give them the chance to speak out and to open their hearts, you will find that these are the true leaders of Egypt. But you need to give them a chance. Nobody does. Nobody listens to them. It's not because of the politics. It's because of the culture. It's always because you're a kid until you reach 50. And then you become a man. It's cultural. But this culture has to change.
Osama Madani, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Osama Madani is a professor of English literature at Menufia University in Egypt. He's currently studying at Western Michigan University on a Fulbright grant. Madani will deliver a lecture tomorrow night at 6 o'clock in Knaus Hall as part of the Center for Humanities Changing Climate series. It's titled No Country for Old Men, Shifting Cultural Borders in Egypt. You can find links with more information and extended versions of the interviews on West Southwest at wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.